Hi, this is Christopher Kimball. Thanks for downloading this week's podcast. You can go to our website, 177milkstreet.com, for our recipes, culinary ideas from around the world, or our latest cookbooks. Now, here's this week's show. This is Milk Street Radio from PRX. I'm your host, Christopher Kimball.
My husband is from Northern Ireland, and I spent quite a lot of time in Northern Ireland, and a few years ago, I wrote a column in The Guardian. Then I put my version on an Irish stew. And I got so many nasty responses because most people said, but how can you change it? An Irish stew is just mutton and nothing else, you know, mutton and water. And I said, but who wants to eat that?
Yotam Ottolenghi is the author of Sweet, Plenty, and Jerusalem. His latest book, Ottolenghi Simple, focuses on delivering minimal hassle for maximum joy. Whole roasted vegetables topped with creme fraiche, no-bake cheesecakes, fridge-ready dressings, and a new take on salads. But before we chat with Yotam, it's my interview with Yvette van Boven, author of Homemade Christmas. Yvette, how are you?
I'm fine. Thank you.
So before we get to the food, what's the worst holiday party you've ever been to? Because you obviously wrote this book based upon experience. And you must have gone to some really horrible parties. So what are some of the things that went wrong in this terrible party?
Oh, dear.
Party?
I do have examples.
And don't mention names. Don't mention names.
Yeah, I suppose they're not listening. But yes, we did have a family dinner once where there was not enough food, for example.
Oh, well, that's kind of a...
And not enough drink. You know, the people say, oh, is the bottle empty already? And we are 12 people, so You need more than two bottles. So that was awful. Yeah, that was awful. Everybody just shared one chicken and it was just not enough. Because it wasn't because they were not generous. It was because the people who were serving the food did not eat that much. So they had no idea how much they would serve for 12 people.
It sounds like a Dickens, like a David Copperfield.
Well, it wasn't like that at all, no.
I mean, it wasn't Pickwick. It was something a little meaner, probably. So do you believe in a smaller menu? I've always said to people, look, cook two things well, not eight things badly.
Yeah.
So you like a small menu?
I like a small menu, or make a big menu, but then ask others to bring or cook at your house and make another course. So you can just focus on, let's say, the main course and a dessert or something, and let the others bring the starters.
What is Dutch French toast?
That is actually nice. We call it wentelteefje. The French eat it sweet. We can eat it savory too. It's a stale bread that you would leave in some egg with milk, and you would leave it there to steep for a couple of minutes, and then you'll bake it, which is quite good. And it's a good way to finish up old bread.
Oatmeal pancakes, you take some oats and throw them in a food processor or blender and use that as a flour, right?
Yeah.
And why? Is it make it better pancake with the oats? Or?
No, but it makes it more, I think it makes them less fluffy, of course, but it makes them more savory, something I like better. Because I think a lot of dishes around Christmas are quite sweet. There's a lot of chocolate and a lot of sweet going on.
Pine syrup. Tell me about pine syrup.
That was something I thought was quite interesting because I like to use the Christmas tree as an ingredient in your cocktails. So just cut off some branches and let it macerate and steep into some syrup, and use that syrup in any cocktails. I even made Negronis with them, but it's actually really delicious. It's even nice just with water. It's quite nice.
Rillette is a classic dish.
Yeah.
You want to just explain how people make it. You braise meat, you shred it. I mean, what's the basic recipe?
The basic recipe is actually you make it from bits and pieces that you have left over in meat, especially fatty meat like porks or goose. And you would cook it down really slowly that the fat renders out, and then you would mix it and it will become like a spreadable pate. And you would add some spices to it just to make it your own. I've made it from rabbit in this, which is a very lean meat. So it's not a real riette, but it's still very nice. It's nice and light. And I add the fat because it doesn't have a natural fat, so I add your own fat.
Makes me feel good. Someone's adding fat. I think that's instead of taking it out.
No, you have to add fat sometimes. Fat is the best. It's one of the best tastes ever, and it carries a lot of taste also.
What is a fruit salami?
Oh, a fruit salami is, I make it from dried fruits, like a fig or prunes or apricots, and mix them up with nuts. And if you chop them up really finely and you would roll them into a piece of parchment paper, you would roll it into a sausage-like shape and then keep it in the fridge. And if you add some, you can add some spices to it to make it Christmassier, like cloves or cinnamon or star anise, and it will get that nice Christmassy taste. And it's also really good sliced nice and thin with some cheese.
Is the turkey persona non grata in Holland for holidays is just not something that's a centerpiece? It's a goose, it's something else?
Or no, I think turkey and goose are more English or Irish. We would actually cook more beef, I would say, or pork. And we have these sets they would put on the table, and I have not put this in my book because I hate it.
You sure? Is that how you really feel about it?
Yes, I really hate it. I really hate it. Okay. We call it gourmet, and it's for Dutch people who don't know how to cook. It's like a small heater. Mm-hmm. Well, it's quite big, actually. You have to put it on the table, and everybody has to sit around it, and everybody gets a little pan, and you have all the ingredients at the table, and everybody can just cook.
Oh, I don't like that.
I
want you to cook.
That's it. I think that's dinner without love. That's nobody. No, just do it yourself, man. And here's the sauce, and just pour
it
over.
That'd be a great book title: Dinner Without Love. maybe that'll be your next book. So you get to make three things for Christmas. That's it.
Yeah.
What are you going to make?
I will definitely have.
And I'm coming over for dinner, by the way.
So
that's a little caveat.
Okay.
Here. What? I always invite myself over because nobody invites me. So.
They don't. Are they scared?
No, but I'm coming over for dinner. You're going to make three things.
I'm going to make you three things.
Yeah.
Okay. So I might make you razor clams. Then I will steam them in just a couple of minutes, just very shortly. And I would pour over some tarragon butter. Mm-hmm. And as a main course, we are not having a meat dish, but we will have a vegetable dish. And it's ox heart cabbage, and I char it in a big casserole, and then baste it with butter and a fish sauce, which is actually really good. Mm. Everything gets balanced out, and all these, it's the sweetness of the cabbage and the saltiness of the fish sauce and the fattiness and the richness of the butter. It's perfect. Hey,
what is ox heart cabbage?
Ox heart cabbage is a cabbage that it's a white cabbage or light green, and it's a bit pointy.
I could use Napa cabbage, maybe?
Yes,
yeah, okay.
Exactly. You could use that. That's a perfect one. Yeah.
And what's my third course?
And your third course is, as you are coming over to me, and I hope it's in Amsterdam, I will give you a tasting of all our Dutch cheeses. Mm. Well, not all of them, but I will highlight some really good ones. You'll be surprised.
So we're going to have a lot of time to talk and drink.
Lovely. Wouldn't that be nice?
That's the perfect menu. It's simple, so we can do all the fun stuff.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, but you have to do it simple. And then...
Yeah. I'm with you.
Yeah, yeah. And pour some good wine.
Yvette, thank you so much for being here on Milk Street.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
That was Yvette van Boven. Her new book is called Homemade Christmas. Milk Street Radio is also available as a podcast. You can subscribe and listen whenever you want. New shows go up every Friday on Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, Stitcher, Radio Public, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. Now it's time to answer your culinary questions with my co-host, Sarah Moulton. Sarah is, of course, the author of Home Cooking 101 and the star of Sarah's Weeknight Meals on public television. Sarah, are you ready?
I am so ready, Chris. Welcome to Milk Street. Who's on the line?
My name is Trudy. How are you?
I'm good. What is your question today?
I have a German recipe. It's called Bienenstich. And I have tried forever to make it. I can get the topping. I can get the filling. But the actual cake-like batter thing, it just eludes me. And most of them on the internet call for a yeast dough.
Yeah.
Let's go back. This Bienenstich, could you just describe when it's finished, what it looks like and what the components are? Because I'm not familiar with it.
Okay. The filling is made of whipped cream and vanilla pudding.
Mm-hmm.
And then the topping is butter, sugar, almonds, cinnamon, vanilla, and heavy cream. And you pour that on top of the batter before it's baked. And it makes this incredible crunchy topping.
How does the filling
get into the cake?
Dough, into the cake. How does that work?
You bake the cake with the topping.
Uh-huh.
And then you slice the cake.
I see. Okay.
Across.
Gotcha.
And put the filling.
And then you
fill it,
and then you let it sit in the fridge, preferably overnight.
Is this baked in a springform pan of some kind or a cake pan?
I usually do it in a 9x12 pan.
Okay. So the cake itself, ideally, what should the texture of the cake be?
It's like a cake, but a cake that is heavy enough in texture-wise to keep that topping on the top while it's baking.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, most of the recipes on the internet call for a yeast dough, and the yeast dough is just too dry. Now, my uncle was a baker in Germany, and he said the flour over here is different.
No, I mean, the only difference would be the absorption of liquid might be different because the amount of gluten in the flour would be different.
But that could make a difference. That could make for a dry cake.
But you could just adjust by adding a little more liquid. You know, the Smitten Kitchen, I think at one time, did this recipe. So you might want to go check that out.
I think so. I mean, it's hard to say how to change the proportions, but I think that the problem with the flour might be really the problem because different gluten flours absorb different amounts of liquid. And so if this dough is a little dry, it might be that maybe you needed to cut back a little bit on the flour, or maybe you needed to up the fat content or the eggs, which also have some fat content.
So you make a yeast dough, you let it rise, goes down, you put it in the 9x12, you let it rise a second time, put the topping on and bake it, is that right?
Yes, but it comes out too dry. And it doesn't matter how long the cake with the filling stays in the refrigerator. It can be in there 2 days and it's still like, it's just like too dry.
Another thought I had is if they usually made it round, you know, then maybe what it is you're spreading out the batter too thin, you know, and so it dries out in baking.
You know what? I've never made this, but go to Smitten Kitchen. I think she did this recipe a few years ago.
Okay.
And I think she could probably solve your problem.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I will certainly give it a try.
But boy, I'm going to go to Smitten Kitchen and make it. It sounds delicious.
Yeah, yeah, it sure does.
It is absolutely wonderful.
Well, I'll tell you what. All three of us are going to go to smittenkitchen.com, get the recipe, and bake it for the holidays, right?
Yes. Okay. Sounds like a plan.
Trudy, thank you so much for calling. A pleasure.
Yes, yes. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for your input.
Sure.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Welcome to Milk Street. Who's calling?
Hi, this is Nathan from Columbus, Ohio.
Hi, Nathan from Columbus. How can we help you today?
So I recently inherited my grandmother's Guardian Service waterless aluminum roaster, and she used it for 50 years, and it's just an absolute mint condition. And so I have two questions about it. First, I'm scared to use it because then I'll have to clean it. So how do I clean it and maintain it so I can pass it on to my kids? And then second, is there a secret to cooking in waterless aluminum versus any other type of roasting pan?
Wow.
Well, there's a company, Kuhn Recon, in Switzerland, I think, who makes this cookware. I think they pioneered this. And essentially what happens is a vacuum is created, and so there's no moisture loss, and that's how it works. My understanding is I've seen some of this cookware. It's not super heavy.
Yeah. Do you know if yours is lined at all, or is it straight aluminum?
I believe it's straight aluminum. It's from the 50s and the whole thing,
The one thing is if it's unlined aluminum, it can react with acid and milk and, you know, change the color of some foods. That's the only downside. Aluminum is a great conductor of heat after copper. I mean, it's way down, but it's the second best. So that's good. In terms of cleaning it, I don't know. Chris, do you know?
It can get that discoloration,
You
know, which is not food stuck to it. It just discolors over time, and you get that sort of grayish
right. color to it, which yeah. I think is what you're talking about. I use Barkeeper's Friend for cleaning. Sometimes I'll put water in a pot and put it back on the stove and then scrub it. Sometimes that works, but I can't get rid of that grayish color.
Okay.
You know, I will say that this is for moist cooking. You're not going to get crispy chicken or anything cooking in this item because it's covered cooking, correct?
Right, yeah. And it seemed like that whenever I looked up how to use it online, most of the cooking was fairly colorless.
Yes, it has to be because there's no air circulating there. So it's probably very moist, yummy food, but with no crispy skin, I mean, which is fine.
It's sort of like using a pressure cooker. It's its own thing, so you have to get good at it and know what it's good for. In my kitchen, I tend to stick with the stupid pots, the ones that don't have a specific technique to them. Or you could find a lovely space on your shelf, and it could be... It could be part Grandma's. Of your family. Yeah, it could be part of, you know, heirloom. The old cookbooks. It's heirloom. Yeah. It's like an heirloom tomato.
Well, I've thought about that.
That might be your best bet. So you don't have to worry about destroying it, but it's still in pristine condition.
Right.
And just buy a Dutch oven.
Thanks. Thanks,
anyway,
Nathan.
Thanks, Nathan.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
You're listening to Milk Street Radio. If you have a cooking question or failure, call us at 855-426-9843. That's 855-426-9843. Or send us an email at questions@milkstreetradio.com. Welcome to Milk Street. Who's calling?
Hi, this is Peter Schindler.
How are you?
I'm great, thank you, and really quite tickled to talk to you. I've admired your work a long time.
Well, we'll see how you feel at the end of the
when
call.
When he's done with you.
But things are starting out well anyway.
Yeah.
So how can we help you?
Well, I was admiring this recipe for the sticky toffee pudding. Mm-hmm. I am... someone who makes steamed puddings quite a lot. I'm wondering if I need to make any adjustments to the recipe in order to do it that way.
Actually, I made this recipe steamed last Thanksgiving.
Oh, you did?
Because my oven died right at an inopportune moment. And so I did do it. I put a little cooling rack at the bottom of a large pot and put some water in it, and I steamed it, and I covered it with parchment paper and string, et cetera. And it worked great.
How long did you steam it for?
Hour and a half or something like that. But it cooked fine. So now, are you going to do this in a bundt pan or in a actual?
No, I have one of those Edgar steaming basin things with a nice aluminum lid and a tube in the center and so on.
Yeah, so it's got a top to it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would work fine.
Can I ask a question of the two of you since you're experts at steaming? Does it come out more moist then from steaming? Is that the point of steaming?
I think it does, yeah, but it's a more gentle consistent surround heat, so I like the way it bakes, but I think, yes, I would say it's somewhat more moist, yes.
Okay. Huh.
Yeah.
I have a particular fondness for the English Christmas pudding thing, and uses a fair bit of Guinness in it, and I like the way it cooks the fruit. It doesn't mush them up. They stay individual, but very moist and succulent. So I agree with Chris.
Okay, nice
to hear.
I think
we should bring back, well, steaming, you know, people didn't have ovens, right? I mean, most people couldn't afford an oven.
So this is how they'd approximate.
There's a baker in town that would do your baking. So this is how you cooked over coals or over a stovetop. It's a great way to cook.
Yeah. You
know, it's very simple.
My grandmother used to make one every Christmas and then put a ton of alcohol on it and then make hard sauce.
The lady who taught me to do Christmas puddings made them in January and kept them in her very cool cellar and soaked it with an ounce of brandy every month.
Well, why not? Yeah.
An ounce of brandy for the pudding, an ounce of brandy for the
you.
Cook.
Yeah, right.
That's pretty good. Yeah.
Right.
Well, that's when aging really does help.
Yeah.
You know, the Christmas pudding. No, they're delicious. I think people should bring those back.
Yeah, I think you should do that in Milk Street.
And they're not fruitcake, okay?
No. We have to make that quite clear.
It's not fruitcake.
Not fruitcake.
I used to make a chocolate steam pudding.
I see this in a future magazine.
And it was just delicious.
Delicious, yeah. I want to do it.
Yeah, you can certainly do it. Go right ahead.
All right, Peter. Thank you. Yay.
Thank you so much.
Pleasure.
Take care.
This is Milk Street Radio. I'm Christopher Kimball. Coming up next, my interview with chef and author Yotam Ottolenghi, right after the break. This is Milk Street Radio. I'm Christopher Kimball. When I picked up my first Yotam Ottolenghi cookbook, Plenty, it transformed my cooking forever. He taught me the magic of spices, how to rethink vegetables, and the fundamentals of contrast and texture and taste. His new book, Ottolenghi Simple, extracts the essence of his cooking philosophy, but with simpler recipes. Yo, Tom, how are you?
I'm very good, thank you.
Thanks for coming back on the show. Appreciate it. I love your new book, Simple, and we'll get to that in a moment. We haven't spent much time talking about you, so we're going to talk about you for a while. So you grew up in Jerusalem. You had Italian grandparents in Florence, is that right?
Yeah, well, they came from Florence. They immigrated to Israel, then Palestine, just before the Second World War.
So did you go to Florence as a kid?
Yeah, so when I was growing up, they still kept a house there, so we would go there occasionally on summer holidays. And I have very fond memories of going to Florence and spending time both in the city and outside where they had the house.
You served in the Israel Defense Forces intelligence. So what was that like, if you can say? If you can talk about it.
I don't think I can say much. I mean, I had an office job, which was quite good for someone who was just generally terrified of anything that involves guns and all the rest. So I was tucked away in an office, which suited me very well.
Then you go to get a master's degree on, if I'm getting this right, the ontological status of the photographic image in aesthetic and analytic philosophy. Is there? Did I read that right?
Yeah, you read it right. I remember very little out of this. I can probably tell you one or two things about it, but I did study that, philosophy and comparative literature, and my dissertation was about imagery and photographs and their relation to the real world. So In which way a photograph is a representation of the world or a natural object.
That actually sounds fairly relevant to today. So you end up working for one of the big newspapers there. You move to the UK in the late 90s, and you end up at Le Cordon Bleu. You know, it's interesting. A lot of people from the newspaper business end up in the food business. Is there some reason for that, or that was just completely random?
Well, you know, I don't know if there's a direct connection, but I know that a lot of people that work in... I worked at the news desk, and I was processing the news as it arrived and then putting it together into the page for next morning's edition. And the newsroom was a high-octane, high-adrenaline, lots of nicotine at the time kind of environment. And it is a little bit like service in a kitchen. There's a lot of pressure for a very short amount of time, and then all of a sudden, it's finished. The moment the newspaper goes to print, you're done. And I remember having a very similar experience when I started doing service in restaurant at the end of the shift, where you are completely hyper. You know, you've just been on an adrenaline rush for a few hours and wanting to go to bed, but it's not going to happen, you know. So it's that kind of intensity is actually quite similar.
So here's a question about growing up in Israel. This was all the Levant, greater Syria at one time, right? Mm-hmm. People moved around a lot. So if you lived in Syria, you might go to Lebanon or you might whatever. So a lot of these dishes in that entire region are quite similar, although they're very different region to region. Did you notice that? Did you experience similar dishes from different people in different places as you grew up? Or was it you just had the one version that you're used to?
No, absolutely the former. So when I was growing up in Jerusalem, there was an incredible diversity of cuisines around. There were lots of recently arrived Jewish communities from all over the world, and there were the local Palestinians. And you would find, especially with Jews coming from North Africa and the Middle East, you'd find incredible similar versions to traditional Palestinian dishes with different names, with a slightly different variation. So in the book Jerusalem, Sami and I give a lot of examples. One of them is kibbeh or kibbeh, which is the Syrian version, is bulgur wheat paste, which is stuffed with a lamb and pine nut filling and then deep fried. So the bulgur kind of develops a skin in which the meat is encased. And it's a very popular dish in the whole Levant. And, you know, Palestinians love it, Syrians, Lebanese, Jordanians. But when you move a little bit further east to Iraq and Kurdistan, you find similar versions of this dish, but sometimes the bulgur is substituted with rice. Sometimes instead of deep fried, it is poached in a soup. So something which looks really similar in one culture has got a, and even has the same name, has a widely different variation in a different culture. Mm. So that throughout my childhood and in different parts of the Middle East, you'd find those variations in abundance.
So when someone waves the flag of authenticity at you, you kind of smile because you know a dish has got 500 different versions depending on who's cooking it?
I take care not to smile because it's a very sensitive subject.
Inside.
You know, it's very, very difficult. This is a very hot topic, you know, right. Cultural appropriation, what right. belongs to whom and what's the right version. And I try not to be too, you know, not to brush it off too easily because for many people, this is extremely important right. because it symbolizes, you know, struggle or difficulty or cultural independence, all sorts of things. So it's you know, for someone who lives in a relatively affluent culture, food is a luxury. In other cultures, it's a mean of identifying yourself and, you know, placing yourself in the world, on a map of the world right. in a particular way. And this is true all over the world. So I try not to be too sensitive when it comes to these subjects. And I try to say to people, you know, you should really be a little bit more lighthearted about it. But it really, you need to judge on a case-by-case basis. Right. I mean, for some people, it is really, really important. So you need to be a little bit careful. But generally speaking, I like to look at it a bit lightheartedly. And I'll give you an example. I have a really good example. My husband is from Northern Ireland, and I spent quite a lot of time in Northern Ireland. And a few years ago, I wrote a column in The Guardian about Irish food or my take on Irish food. And I put my version on an Irish stew. And I got so many nasty responses because I added to adulterate the... So most people said, but how can you change it? An Irish stew is just mutton and nothing else, you know, mutton and water. And I said, like, but who wants to eat that? So, you know, I added...
That went over, you know, well.
I added a bit of orange zest and some parsley and a few more interesting vegetables. But the funny thing is that the people that were enraged were not Irish. They were English. So, you know, on some occasions you can laugh about it. And that was a really great opportunity to laugh because what was at stake was really nothing. But so, like I said, it's a case-by-case basis.
So let me do something. I went through your book very carefully. Actually, you know, I cooked Sunday. And this mm-hmm. I thought this was brilliant and simple. You had a cherry tomato sauce for pasta, right?
Yeah.
And I never thought of this. You took 5 tablespoons of oil, a little less than a cup of water, and you cooked those cherry tomatoes for an hour. And the water allowed you to cook
with some chilies.
With some chilies, yes, that's right. And it was unbelievable. And then you threw in a couple handfuls, as Otto Lengi books do, of basil or whatever. But mm-hmm. the long cooking, and I had pretty crummy supermarket cherry tomatoes. It was really good. It was absolutely fabulous. Anyway, so that was a concept to take away. But let's go through, I made a list of things. You know, ideas that you use in cooking that maybe other people, at least this side of the Atlantic, have thought of. Roasting a whole vegetable. You know, it's very common, as you know, to do eggplant, for example. But could you just talk about roasting an entire vegetable in one piece?
Yeah, so I find that one of the most, you know, the easiest way in the kitchen. So if I have a little bit of time, which it's not ideal if you want to put something on a table within 25 minutes, but if I have a little bit of time, I take a whole vegetable. And it could be anything from a cabbage to a cauliflower to a rutabaga or a celery root. And I drizzle them with oil and put lots of really good salt. And I either cover them with foil individually or wrap them together or wrap them in a tray and just leave them there for a good 1 or 2 hours or 3 hours. It depends on the vegetable. And that's actually almost all the cooking you need to do. I mean, after that, you could do a few other things. You can make a salsa or a sauce to go with. You can serve it with some creme fraiche and a drizzle of, you know, lemon or something along that line. But it is really as simple as that. And what happens is that with a long cooking, everything kind of the sugar starts to make to give you caramelization, and the vegetable just tastes more and more of its own self.
Right.
If you see what I mean. And everybody, I mean, many people have discovered this recently with a cauliflower, that, and I've got a recipe in the book as well. If you put it in a pot of water and boil it for 3 minutes and then roast it, leaves and everything, for a good hour after that with lots of olive oil, you get the sweetest, most delicious cauliflower that really doesn't need anything else apart from that.
You mentioned drizzles, and that's, you know, in southern India, they use tarka, which is, as you know, flavored ghee or oil with spices. And you do that very often in your book, Simple. So the idea of drizzling something flavorful at the end before serving, yeah. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, because if you want to give yourself an easy life and not work too much on building up flavor over a long time or with too many ingredients, I do what they do a lot in Turkish cooking, and that is take a little bit of butter or oil and put some flaked chilies. I like Urfa chilies, but any kind of flaked chili does the work. And the moment that you throw the chilies in, the butter or the oil turns a really deep, beautiful red color and starts to flavor the oil or the butter. And that's spooned over something from vegetables to a meaty stew to eggs, just really transforms the dish. And it's a simple trick, then it has a real transformative effect. I mean, you can also drizzle a bit of lemon juice into that bubbling butter, and then you've got heat, you've got from the chilies, you've got the acidity from the lemon juice, and you've got the bubbling, beautiful fat over it, and that just coats whatever you need to coat. And you don't need much else, really.
Could you give our listeners a 15-second commercial for Urfa pepper?
Yeah, so Urfa peppers or chilies are essentially a variety from Turkey, and they're dried in the sun with a bit of salt and then blitzed up into flakes. And they're extremely dark. They taste smoky, and they're not very spicy. So they're really beautiful when sprinkled over anything with a light color, like a yogurt or eggs. So they're nice, like bright, dark jewels. And they're really, really beautifully smoky. So, you know, from the Mexican side, you'd find ancho or cascabel chilies. It's kind of the Middle Eastern equivalent to those Mexican flavors.
And a little chocolatey, too. It has sort of a...
Yes, yeah. it's got a really nice sweetness and depth of like a chocolatey flavor or licorice-y flavor.
You taught me that salads are not green lettuce with a dressing. You have a slightly more global view of it. So how do you think about a salad? Because I know you do all sorts of great things, but you think about them differently.
I think for me, a salad is any dish that is made out of vegetables that are served cold or at room temperature. And so in my cafes and restaurants, I serve big platters of roasted vegetables or fresh red vegetables, and I dress them lightly with pastes and salsas and different dressings. And for me, that is essentially a salad, something that you eat at room temperature and is vegetable-based. It doesn't need to be a side to anything. So, I mean, traditionally in the Anglo-Saxon tradition, a salad would be served next to something, you know, more substantial, but really, it really doesn't need to be the case. You can take a whole lot of wonderful vegetables and cook them and dress them nicely, and you have a whole loads of salads that just make up a meal. You don't need really anything else apart from that.
You know, we're on the verge now in the States of sort of a spice revolution, as you well know, partially due to you. So let's take five spices the typical household may not have on hand. What should they buy and why?
So I divide spices into, it's a very crude differentiation, but to sweet and savory. So on the sweet side, you'd find things like cinnamon and allspice and nutmeg. So from that department, I really, really love star anise. Star anise is used a lot in Asian cooking and Southeast Asian cooking, and you can buy it as they look like beautiful stars, but you can also grind it into a powder or buy it as powder. That's a really great great spice to have. And another one from the aniseed department is either fennel seeds or aniseeds. You know, they're quite similar in flavor. And we are all familiar with aniseedic flavors from tarragon, from basil, from chervil. So if you take those herbs and mix them together with fennel seeds or with aniseeds, you get another layer of those aniseedy flavors, which are really great with both vegetables and meat and fish. Then I really like moving from the sweet to the more savory. Another sweet-ish is cardamom. Ground cardamoms are the most wonderful things. And for both desserts and added to, I've got a recipe in this book for soba noodle salads with avocado and lots of cilantro, lots of onion. And I add some ground cardamom to it. And it, with the addition of a squeeze of lime, it's like heaven. Really, really good.
Sumac roasted strawberries. Talk about that.
Delicious. So, you know, sumac is such a great ingredient because it's dry, it sits there, it has quite a long shelf life, but it brings a lot of wonderful acidity and great color.
You want to explain what it is? Just explain what it is.
Sumac are the crushed, dried berries of a tree that grows. It actually grows all over the world, but it's mostly found now in the Middle East and Iran. And it's got a really sharp, sharp flavor. It's great with meat, but it's also wonderful added to salad dressing and to roasted vegetables. So what you were referring to is a dessert that I have in the book, where you take strawberries and you roast them with sumac. So the redness is even more amplified by the redness of the sumac, and the acidity is heightened by the sharpness of the sumac. And that's served with drained yogurt. So you take really rich yogurt and get those roasted strawberries with a bit of mint. And it's a really kind of straightforward dessert that is just really wonderful.
As you're cooking, or the way you like to cook, let's assume you're not publishing books, you're not doing restaurants or delis. You're just home and you're cooking with family. Mm. How do you cook now versus 20 years ago? I assume it's different.
Yeah, it's true. I've got young children. It does affect the way you cook quite dramatically. So it explains a bit about this book and how it came to be. And that is that I think, as someone who's turning 50 this year, I tried to probably impress a bit less with my food and think a bit more about the function and how it functions in people's lives. And when I come home from work, I don't always make dinner. Mostly it's Carl, my husband, who makes dinner. But if I do need to make dinner, I would make something that I know the kids will definitely eat and won't be thrown away. I know that I make something that can be done within 30 minutes and doesn't involve a whole lot of washing up afterwards. I become very pragmatic about it. It still needs to be delicious and special. So I make something like a mejadra, which is a very simple Middle Eastern dish of rice and lentils with some fried onion in it. And it's got sweet spices, but not much else. And the kids love it. It's not fireworks, but it's really, really good. It's really delicious. And when you put a dollop of good yogurt on it, you've got a wonderful meal. And, you know, I said my kids are not especially picky. This is a dish that I have any day and I can easily make within half an hour. But the trick is the fried onion. I mean, it's not going to be as good if you don't add some fried onion to it.
Yeah, Tom, thank you so much. All the best. I know your new book, Simple, is doing very well. Well-deserved. And we'll catch
thank
up
you
with
very
you
much.
Next year.
Thank you.
That was chef and author Yotam Ottolenghi. His new book is entitled Ottolenghi Simple, a Cookbook. You know, spices have been around since at least the time of the pharaohs, used as preservatives and also for health. The king of Babylon grew 64 different herbs in the royal garden. That was 700 BC. At the same time, spices were incredibly popular in India and then later in Greece and Rome. In medieval Europe, spices were expensive. A pound of saffron cost as much as a horse. And then as prices fell, so did their use. Post-revolution French cooking was a spice-free zone. Well, today, spices are back in favor. Maybe someday we'll know as much about them as the king of Babylon almost 3,000 years ago. It's time to chat with Catherine Smart about this week's recipe, Taiwanese beef noodle soup. Catherine, how are you?
I'm great, thanks. How are you?
You know, when I went to Taipei not too long ago, I spent half a day with Zhuang Baohua. She is a culinary teacher, very well known. She's taught over 70,000 students. And she has a very simple school. It's on the second floor of a sort of nondescript commercial building. And we made a couple recipes. One was beef noodle soup. Now, it takes a couple hours. She uses beef bones. She uses beef suet. She uses maybe 20 different spices and ingredients, wok, and she uses also a big pot. And it was great. but obviously a lot of work to transport it and make it for the American home cook. So how do we take that recipe and transform it here at Milk Street?
Well, Chris, we had our work cut out for us. So what we decided to do is just start by sauteing your aromatics, so your ginger, your garlic, some spices like star anise. That kind of builds the flavor base. And then we didn't make homemade stock and we didn't use store-bought stock. We just simmered beef shanks, which was the cut that we found, produced really tender meat and a really flavorful stock. We simmered that and that makes the base. And then you just shred the meat, add it back into the broth with some store-bought wheat noodles. You're looking for a fresh noodle, any sort of Asian style fresh wheat noodle. And then we finished it with some greens. So Chris, once you add the beef shanks, you just want to keep it at a simmer, make sure it's not boiling too aggressively, but then you can just kind of go about your day. It's going to hang out for about 2 hours before you shred the meat and add it back into the pot with the noodles and the greens.
So it takes about the same amount of time that it took in Taipei, but with about half as many ingredients.
Yes, and I think it's important to say, Chris, what an incredibly flavorful dish this is. There's a little bit of a longer ingredient list, but the actual work is very minimal, and it's extremely flavorful and packed with umami.
Meat, broth, noodles, and greens. I mean, that's why it's the national dish of Taiwan. It was like the perfect combination. Catherine, thank you.
Thanks, Chris. You can find this recipe and all of our recipes at 177milkstreet.com.
You're listening to Milk Street Radio. Coming up, J. Kenji Lopez-Alt demystifies the science of vinaigrettes. We'll be right back. This is Milk Street Radio. I'm Christopher Kimball. It's time for this week's Milk Street Basic. Here's a tip from Chef Alon Shaya, also author of the cookbook Shaya, to add flavor quickly and easy to almost any dish. It's an herb-flavored salt. One part kosher salt to one part herb. Grind them together with a food processor. Store the mix in a sealed container in the freezer where the flavor actually intensifies over time. Now, here are three recipes. Equal parts sage and rosemary and two parts parsley. Or you can add equal parts marjoram and rosemary and just a little bit of thyme. And finally, you can have 50% cilantro, 50% parsley, and then add in half of a serrano chili. For more tips and ideas, please go to 177milkstreet.com. Next up, J. Kenji Lopez-Alt illuminates another kitchen mystery. Kenji, how are you?
I'm doing good. How are you?
You know, over the years, we've worked together and then been in the same industry for quite a few years now, not working together, but you and I see eye to eye on a lot of things, but vinaigrettes is one of those topics that, you know, I argue with everybody about vinaigrettes. So let's have a vinaigrette argument. So
okay.
You, I know, have done quite a lot of work on this. So why don't you start out with what you know and believe about vinaigrettes?
Okay, we can start by defining a vinaigrette. A vinaigrette is essentially just a salad dressing that's composed of an acidic element, so usually vinegar or citrus juice, combined with oil. Like, those are the two basic parts of a vinaigrette, usually olive oil. To that, you can add other flavorings. Shallots, garlic, black pepper, salt are very common herbs. And then you usually also include an emulsifier of some kind, which can also double as a flavoring. So generally, like with a very classic French vinaigrette, that's going to be mustard. So Dijon mustard, shallots, a little vinegar, and some olive oil. That's like your basic French vinaigrette. Now, where things get complicated is the technique involved. So you could just take all those ingredients and separately dump them on your salad greens in a bowl and toss it all together. And I know in a lot of French bistros, a lot of French cafes, they will do this. They'll form it tableside, have all the ingredients separate, toss it very well, serve right. It to you immediately. The problem with this method, though, and maybe when you're in a small French cafe where you've probably had a lot of wine and you're in a good mood and you like seeing this tableside service, and most importantly, you're eating the salad basically immediately after it's dressed. They put it on your plate, you start eating it because of that tableside service. Your salad's going to be fine. But if you were to let that salad to sit made with a very sort of loose vinaigrette where all the ingredients are added separately, what you'll find with time is that the vinegar element or the citrus element, any sort of water-based liquid, which vinegar and citrus juice are, they're essentially water with some acid, any kind of water-based liquid is going to eventually drain off the leaves and kind of puddle at the bottom of your plate. If you ever walk outside after it rains and look at the way water pools on leaves, you'll see that leaves of all kinds are made to shed water. The water doesn't get absorbed, water doesn't make them wilt, anything like that. It's because leaves have this sort of oil-based, sort of waxy cuticle on them that it sheds off water, but it is very good at absorbing oil. So when you make a vinaigrette, your oil will actually get absorbed by the leaves. And if you've seen a salad starting to wilt, it's the oil in there that's causing it to wilt. Yeah, it's not the acid, not the water. You can take a bucket of vinegar, throw salad greens in there and let it sit for half an hour, drain them off, and they'll be fresh. Do the same thing with a bucket of oil, and they'll be completely wilted. When you're emulsifying, what you're doing is you're essentially taking two things that don't mix very well together, so water and oil in this case, and dispersing them so finely that they form a stable mixture that doesn't break off into a separate water phase and a separate oil phase. And you do that, you know, with vigorous whisking, slowly drizzling in the oil while you're whisking vigorously helps the emulsion. You can do it with a blender. You can do it with a food processor or a hand blender if you'd like to get a stronger emulsion. But, you know, just whisking or shaking in a jar will form a strong enough emulsion that when you then subsequently toss your greens with it, it prevents the acid from, first of all, dripping off the leaves and collecting in the bottom of the bowl or on the bottom of the plate. And more importantly, what it does is it dilutes that oil so that it doesn't break down the lettuce leaves quite as fast. So if you're eating your salad immediately and you're just throwing it on the plate, going to eat it, a loose vinaigrette probably works fine. But if you have a green salad and your goal is to put it on the table and have, you know, it's family style, you have 6 to 8 people there, maybe they're going to eat it right now, maybe they're going to eat it in 15 minutes. In those cases, I very strongly recommend emulsifying the dressing first because it'll help your salad, first of all, taste better and also stay fresher on the table for longer.
Let's talk about technique. Jacques Pepin once told me he just used an old mustard jar, which had a little bit of mustard left in it. He would use that so it would emulsify and you didn't have to use a whisk. So ever since then, I just use a jar. I think you do too, right?
Yeah. I mean, so I have a little like a salad dressing mixer that I think OXO makes it, but it has like a little flip top and it's essentially a jar with measured sides. And I find it useful because you don't really have to use any measuring spoons or tablespoons or anything like that. You can just fill your ingredients to the line. Another thing I do is I have a collection of little plastic squeeze bottles that I've used a Sharpie to draw lines on the side that are essentially sort of bottles with built-in recipes for various vinaigrettes. And so, you know, there's a little line on the jar, it'll say 1 teaspoon of mustard, and then there'll be a line to where to fill the vinegar, and then another line on where to fill the oil. You know, basic ratio is like 3 to 1 oil to vinegar, maybe 2 to 1 oil to vinegar. So you just fill it up to those lines, add whatever seasonings are listed, and then put your finger over the top and shake it up right before using. And for most purposes, shaking is enough to emulsify a dressing, certainly for most home purposes.
So one last point. Okay, now I yield. I'll do an emulsion.
We can both be right.
A little bit
we can
of mustard.
Both be right.
But the unique point here was that oil is what penetrates the leaves and makes it wilt, which is a good point. So the other thing is I think most vinaigrettes are incredibly acidic, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I use very low acid vinegars, under 5%, like a rice wine vinegar or white balsamic.
Right.
Do you find that these 7 or 8% typical harsh vinegars, I just don't like them in vinaigrettes?
I mean, it really depends what I'm in the mood for. But, you know, I do make a number of vinaigrettes at home where I cut the vinegar with another water-based liquid. One recipe I picked up actually from Ken Oringer when I worked at Clio in Boston is this soy vinaigrette where essentially you substitute about a quarter of the vinegar with soy sauce. Huh. You dress your greens with it and it doesn't taste like soy sauce, but it adds, you know, that sort of savoriness to it. Another great technique is using dashi, so like a Japanese stock. You know, you can make a homemade dashi or you can use a little powdered granules, which I think work fine for some applications. But replacing some of the acid with dashi, you know, or even just plain water, you can cut your acid with a little bit of water if you find it too vinegary. So that comes down to personal preference. So the nice thing about understanding the basics of a technique of vinaigrette, understanding the ratio of water to oil and how to emulsify it, is that you can change up any of those ingredients any way you want as long as the ratio is the same. So you can mix out different oils, you can use lemon juice, you can use vinegar, you can cut it with water, and as long as the ratios are the same, your vinaigrette is going to emulsify and is going to dress well.
So Kenji Lopez Alt 1, Christopher Kimball 0. The emulsion is there because the oil will destroy the leaves, the vinegar will roll off like it does in a rain, and a mustard jar or any simple jar will do the trick. Kenji, thank you.
Thank you, Urs.
You've changed my mind. All right. Amazing. Thanks. That was J. Kenji Lopez Alt. He's the chief culinary advisor for Serious Eats, also author of The Food Lab. On today's show, we had the two extremes of the food world. Kenji discussed the science of salad dressings, and Yvette Van Boven cooked up a storm for the holidays. One is a world of gluten and amino acids. The other revels in the rewards of entertaining.
One is about mastering the art. The other is about the joy of cooking. So next time, I'll invite both Yvette and Kenji over for dinner and put them next to each other to see what happens. Maybe that's the most scientific way to find out which approach is best. That's it for this week's show. If you tuned in too late, you can always find Milk Street Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, TuneIn, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Radio Public. Please remember to subscribe to the show. That way you'll get every episode downloaded to your phone or tablet each week. If you want to learn more about Milk Street, head on over to 177milkstreet.com. There you can download each week's recipe, watch the new season of our TV show, or order our new book, Milk Street Tuesday Nights. You can also find us on Facebook at Christopher Kimball's Milk Street and on Instagram and Twitter at 177milkstreet. We'll be back next week, and thanks, of course, for listening.
Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio is produced by Milk Street in association with WGBH. Executive producer, Melissa Baldino. Senior audio editor, Melissa Allison. Producer, Annie Sinzava. Associate producer, Jackie Nowak, and production help from Debbie Paddock. Senior audio engineer, Douglas Sugarts. Additional editing from Vicki Merrick and Sydney Lewis, and audio mixing from Jay Allison at Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. Theme music by Two Bob Crew. Additional music by George Brendel Egloff. Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio is distributed by PRX.